Hello, and welcome to Fast Track. My name is Will Sweetser. I'm a first-year medical student at the George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences, and a vice president of the Emergency Medicine Interest Group. The purpose of this podcast is to help students find out if emergency medicine is right for them, and to hear from interesting speakers about their path to emergency medicine. We hope this resource and others on our website help students along their path through medical school, residency applications, and into residency. Listeners will hear from different perspectives within emergency medicine, from students to residents to attendings. This podcast is being virtually recorded with our guest speaker, Dr. Chris Lenhart. Dr. Lenhart is the element scientist for the Exploration Medical Capability, a branch of NASA's Human Research Program, as well as a senior faculty member with the Baylor College of Medicine in the Center for Space Medicine in the Department of Emergency Medicine. He is board certified in emergency medicine in both Canada and the United States and works clinically in the emergency department at the Ben Taub Hospital in Houston. He completed his medical degree and emergency medicine residency at Western University in Canada. I think the opening question is kind of a very basic and broad one, but just how did you get into space medicine in your current post? It's a little bit different than what most people think for emergency medicine.
Yeah, it's definitely unique. And in fact, if you had asked me when I was going through med school or my emergency medicine residency, if I ever thought I was going to end up working at NASA, I would have told you you were crazy. So it certainly was never my specific intention, but it's a very happy circumstance that it worked out the way it did. So for me, in case the listeners haven't figured it out yet, I am originally from Canada, and so you will hear that in my voice periodically when I say certain words. But as a kid growing up in Canada, I was actually primarily interested in space when I was younger, but I also had a love of biology. And one of my high school guidance counselors said, have you ever thought about medicine? And I said, frankly, no, I hadn't. And they shared with me the biographies of Canadian astronauts, and one of the Canadian astronauts was an emergency physician. And I was like, cool, he became an emergency physician, and then he went to space. That sounds pretty good. Why don't I just do that? And so that's how I started on my emergency medicine path, was by looking at trying to emulate people that I wanted to be like. And it was through that work in my emergency medicine residency, and then the work I did afterwards when I was starting to work as an attending, where I decided to really try and develop my niche interest in space medicine and find a way that I could apply it to the kind of problems I was really interested in, which was how do we provide medical care to people in really difficult environments outside of the hospital that we all get used to in medical school and residency? How do you learn how to be autonomous and fully functioning without all of the stuff around you?
Okay. And then I remember from your bio that you're also a reservist with the Air Force, the Canadian Air Force.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've been a reservist with the Royal Canadian Air Force as a medical specialist for a number of years now. And a lot of that, that interest of mine came out of my desire to be involved in space medicine. And so I think one of the key takeaways that I've had from looking back on my career is that if you try and specifically define exactly where you're going to go, and you aren't willing to consider deviations or changes to your plan, you're going to miss stuff. And so I had no intention of joining the military when I was in med school or even residency. But I was looking for ways to get into the world of space medicine. And that started with me actually finding a small list of people in Canada who did space medicine activities for the Canadian Space Agency. And I just sent them emails out of the blue. I'm some random medical student resident guy who really wants to learn how to do this stuff. And how do I do that? And one of those guys that I emailed, he actually worked with the Canadian military, and he said, you're going to come and you're going to do a 1 month elective with me, and you're going to learn about aviation and diving medicine from the military, because that's all a form of extreme environmental medicine. And that experience doing research and learning from people who are working directly with the military in these extreme environments led me to realize that that would be a way that I could learn more and provide something back to my country at the time, so that I could develop that interesting niche that was hard to find a way into. And that was one of my ways to really get involved.
Okay. So then when you were, making back in Canada, kind of doing your work primarily, what was the path that got you into NASA, into your current branch within NASA?
Yeah, so that path back in med school and residency was it was not just impossible to see, it didn't exist. There was at the time there was no it was no defined way for me to do this work. And so what I ended up having to do was I ended up having to basically make my own path. And so through some of the people I had met in the Canadian space medicine community, I started cobbling together experiences and knowledge. And they would say, read this textbook, or here's a cool journal article, or come spend a 1 month with me and we'll do aviation and diving medicine stuff. And I started to develop not only a network of people that were interested in this area, but also a bunch of knowledge and expertise that I was looking for ways to apply. And I frankly, at one point, ran out of them in Canada. I had one of my mentors and I sent them a note one day and I'm like, here's a list of all the stuff I've done. What do I do now? And they said, you got to go where people are doing this stuff, and that's the US. And so I moved at that time to Washington, DC, and I was on faculty at the George Washington University in the Department of Emergency Medicine, and I started to further develop my extreme environmental medicine niche at GW. And it was through that work that I got to meet some people who are working at NASA that ultimately led to my recruitment.
Say, what kind of can you kind of explain more, maybe like about the austere environmental medicine that you've been talking about? Like more broadly, but just kind of like you were talking about military, space, dive medicine. So just kind of how does that look, and how does that differ from maybe what we think more classically, of like hospital-based medicine?
Yeah, it's a very different paradigm than normal hospital medicine. So for the first part of it, I would say is that the normal medicine we see in the hospital is people who are there's nothing wrong with their environment in most cases. In most cases, there's something wrong with their physiology or their anatomy. They have some kind of illness or injury that is independent of their environment. And so that's the paradigm with which we approach most medicine. In extreme environmental medicine, the majority of people who are going into these difficult environments, they're pretty healthy people. So it's not necessarily a problem of their anatomy or their physiology, but it's a problem of their environment. There's something in their environment that is noxious or trying to hurt them. And so in space, it's the vacuum of space. If it's underwater, it's the fact that you can't breathe without your regulator in. If it's in the at altitude, it's the altitude itself that's causing you problems. So the tenets of extreme environmental medicine are that, first of all, there's something in your environment that's trying to kill you or harm you. There's also a lack of access to definitive care. So if you get sick or injured, there isn't an ambulance that you can call or a hospital right down the street that you can go to. You have a lack of access to resources or a paucity of resources at your disposal. So whatever you have on your person or whatever you can improvise is all you have available to you. And then lastly, there's a lot of autonomy, meaning that you are going to be the sole decision maker in that circumstance, and you may or may not have someone you can call or who can assist you to take care of a patient. And so, if you think about the way we practice medicine in the hospital, we are not restricted by any of those parameters in typical medicine. And so, the approach to how you provide medical care in extreme environments is a fundamentally different approach than typical hospital medicine. But it's one that I think is really interesting as a physician to stretch your abilities and knowledge about how you can do things when you don't have the entire infrastructure around you that you're used to having.
Okay. So maybe we can kind of focus more in on space medicine, because obviously that's where you're at a little bit more right now. So what kind of things do you think about for space and how that influences people's physiology, and how do you, what was your research shown, and how was your, your teaching and your instruction have, how, what has that changed for you of how you've approached space medicine?
It's really interesting because I find that my work in space medicine influences my day-to-day work in the emergency department and vice versa. And so from a space to ground kind of view, one of the things that we are challenged with all the time in thinking about exploration missions to the moon and Mars and medical systems for those missions is that we can't take everything we want to take with us. And in fact, if you take something with you that you'd never end up using, then you've wasted that mass and volume that you could have filled with something else that you did need, but you didn't take because you didn't think of it. And so a lot of what we do is an attempt to quantify the risk in a mission and figure out what kind of capabilities or resources we can take with us to reduce that risk. And that means having to think about, can I actually predict which medical conditions the astronauts are going to get before they even get them? So are there ways that I can either do monitoring or screening of astronauts for conditions? Or can I just say that any human in any given year will have X number of muscle strains? And therefore, if the astronauts are in space and they're doing normal exercise in the space environment to maintain their bones and their muscle, they're going to get muscle strains, and therefore I have to include capabilities to treat muscle strains. So a big part of what we do is looking at what is the likelihood of a condition occurring, and then what is the consequence of that condition occurring and us not having the capability to treat it. And so when we work in the emergency department, we see lots of undifferentiated patients, and we have to try to figure out what's going on with them. And as a result, we have a tendency to be fairly liberal with our diagnostic and treatment plans for those folks because we've got all the stuff at our disposal. We should use it. But what I've instead been trying to do in my practice and in working with the residents and the medical students that I work with is actually have them develop a differential diagnosis using the likelihood and consequence of that condition. And so, if it is a high likelihood but low consequence condition, maybe we don't need to do testing for it. Or if it's a very low likelihood but high consequence condition, if the likelihood is too low, then diagnostic testing may not be useful either. So, how do we figure out what's a reasonable approach to testing people? And I've become more judicious and efficient, I think, in my approach to how I see patients in the emergency department because I think about what it would be like to see them in space and having to try to manage them with a paucity of resources at my disposal. So that's the one side of the equation. The
Okay.
other side is the how does what we do on the ground influence space flight? And that's all about trying to take the best available evidence and the best available technology for us when we go on these missions. And historically at NASA, what's happened is that the doctors at NASA have served as subject matter experts, and they've all said, based on my experience, the way you would treat this condition is with this resource. What we're trying to do now is take a more evidence-based approach to it, where we're going to say, well, here's what the literature says is the best way to manage a given condition on the ground. How can we modify that treatment or that management plan in an appropriate way for the space environment, but making sure that we're using the best available evidence? And then over time, as new evidence comes out, we can update all of our treatment plans and all of our system designs to take into account the newest information.
I remember back in the winter time of this year, or maybe it was last year, there was an issue with an astronaut having a blood clot in their neck. And I wonder, down on earth, on the ground, and having a DVT can be significant, but also can be fairly routine. I wonder how that experience and that frame shift affected NASA and how the way you've approached things since then.
That was a fascinating case, and one of the reasons that I think it's particularly fascinating is, like you said, they got it in their neck. We're not used to seeing them in people in their necks on the ground unless they have some kind of significant comorbidity. And so what that was that was a demonstration of how the spaceflight environment changes people. And there's lots of debate about whether or not all of the change in space is actually a bad change. In a lot of cases, it's just us as humans adapting to our new environment. And so we are, as a species, incredibly adaptable, which is why we can go to all these crazy places that we go to. But in that circumstance, we had an astronaut who developed a blood clot, and then we suddenly had to figure out, NASA had to figure out what to do about it. And the reason that that was an interesting case in my mind is because a number of years ago, NASA published something that they call the Exploration Medical Condition List. And that was a list of about 100 things that NASA believed were the either highest likelihood or highest consequence conditions that might occur on an exploration mission. And DVT was not on that list. And
Interesting.
that's because we did not know at the time that DVTs could occur in the space environment with all the fluids that shift in your body and all the way that astronauts move around in microgravity and all the exercise that they do. We simply did not anticipate that condition. And so that, to me, what that says is that on the way to Mars, one or more astronauts is going to get a condition that no one thought was going to happen in space flight, or that we didn't predict was going to happen in space flight. And as a result, we have to make sure that everything we send with them and everything we include in our medical system has as many purposes or uses as possible. And so we call that flexible and multi-use equipment or resources. And so if there is a drug that we decide to send into space to treat a single condition, and that condition doesn't occur, then that drug's just going to expire in space and we're never going to use it. However, if there's a different drug I can use to treat the same condition, and oh, by the way, it treats four other conditions, that's a far more useful inclusion in our medical system than those one-offs. So we have to be prepared for the unexpected, and we have to essentially assume that something will occur that we were not anticipating.
And so maybe can you kind of be a little bit more specific about what the EM physician role is in this whole contingency planning? I'm sure there's different groups of folks from resources and the physicists in all these different areas, but what is kind of more specifically your role or your team's role in developing that plan?
So my team, the group that I work with, Exploration Medical Capability, is a really it's just a fascinating concept in my mind, because we are a research group, but we are made up of clinicians, which includes nurses and doctors and pharmacists. We have epidemiologists. We have engineers, both from the technical hardware side of engineering and also the system design side of engineering, as well as folks who look at human factors. How does the human and the equipment or the vehicle interact with each other? And our entire group together is focused on developing concepts for new medical systems for future missions that are going to go to the moon and Mars. And so our group is not involved in the day-to-day operations that we have right now on the space station. But I had a conversation yesterday with a group of people who were trying to figure out what the medical capability needed to be on a rover that people could live in on the surface of Mars for 30 days. And so we have all kinds of theoretical and interesting discussions about what kinds of conditions could occur, what an appropriate amount of medical care would be on the surface of Mars, and how you could enable it. And so a lot of our work is either research focused or more theoretical. But where it really the rubber starts to hit the road is that our group also tries to take all that knowledge that we're developing in terms of what a medical system should look like, and then we're trying to translate that work into requirements. And to an engineer, a requirement is that the system shall do X. And then it's the engineer's job to figure out how to meet that requirement. And if we don't translate our medical knowledge into engineering language, then the engineers don't know how to make it real. And so not only do we think about all these problems and try to come up with solutions to them, but we then have to take that information and translate it into engineering so that it actually ends up inside the spacecraft.
That's super neat. I wonder how, when there was, I'm guessing there was a medical consult for the individual in the space station who had that DVT in their neck. That I'm sure is probably a quicker phone call than trying to communicate with somebody who's out in Mars. So, like, how does that work as the consulting physician? Like, how do you approach that kind of a situation?
So the way that that's done at NASA is that we have doctors at NASA that serve as flight surgeons, and their job is to provide general medical support to a mission on the space station, but also to provide specific medical support to individual astronauts. And so in the case that you're describing, you're absolutely right. An astronaut develops a blood clot. They call down to the ground. The ground gets their doctor essentially on the phone, and they start having a conversation about what they've had and what they're going to do about it. But that way of taking care of people right now works well on the space station because the space station is 250 miles above our heads. It's closer than I am in Houston to Dallas. So the space station is not far away by distance, and as a result, we have real-time communications with the space station. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, there is always someone to talk to space station if they need to talk. When we start pushing off towards the moon or towards Mars, then we are unfortunately we're victims of the speed of light, and you can only transmit information so fast. And as a result, as we go further and further towards Mars, it's going to take many minutes for information to move between Earth and the spacecraft. And so people won't be able to have real-time conversations with their flight surgeons on the ground when they're halfway to Mars. So we have to think about a new way of doing medicine. And it's essentially a form of telemedicine, which is very similar to what we do here on the ground now. And essentially during our COVID pandemic, we're doing a lot more telemedicine than we've ever done before.
And so you mentioned they're the flight surgeons within NASA, but I was wondering if there are any other kinds of doctors as well within the organization.
Yeah, so the majority of doctors at NASA serve as there's the flight surgeons who take care of the astronauts. There are doctors who take care of the other NASA employees, so occupational medicine doctors. There are doctors who serve in roles like I do, in terms of different research areas within NASA. And then there are some doctors who serve more of an oversight or regulatory role at NASA as well, making sure that we, as the government, do all the right things we're supposed to do to take care of people. So there's a bunch of different paths into NASA as a physician. The most common one, or the one that people are most familiar with, are the flight surgeons who take care of the astronauts. And just for information's sake and from a historical perspective, flight surgeons don't perform surgery. That's a historical military term that we've just hung on to, but you'd be amazed by how many people think they need to be a surgeon in order to be a flight surgeon. So the flight surgeon path is the most typical path at NASA, but there are certainly a significant number of other physicians as well that serve in different roles.
And for the flight surgery, or surgeon, excuse me, do you need to go through any particular branch of the military?
So military is one way to do it, and in fact, a number of our NASA flight surgeons were formerly military flight surgeons, and they transitioned to NASA. There are also civilian aerospace medicine training programs in the United States as well, residencies and fellowships. One of the interesting things for myself, being originally not being an American, is that those training programs were only open to Americans. And so, as a Canadian who was looking to do space medicine, I would have loved to have access to a formal training program in aerospace medicine. But because I did not have access to it, I had to essentially create my own. And that's how I got involved in all of these other extreme environmental medicine activities, was by trying to build up my own knowledge and expertise because I didn't have a formal training path to follow.
Okay. And then for those residencies, that do you end up going through like an emergency medicine, or is it some other specialty that also does the aerospace?
That is a tricky question. And I'll explain why. So historically, when aerospace medicine became a real thing a number of decades ago, as a branch of the military, it was viewed exclusively as occupational medicine. And so as a result, even today, the aerospace medicine board certification is done through occupational and preventative medicine. And so that was the historical way to get into aerospace medicine. Over the years, there have been lots of people who have done internal medicine and then have done aerospace medicine. In the last decade or so, probably the majority of people going through aerospace medicine residencies and fellowships have done emergency medicine. But I also know folks who have come from obstetrics and gynecology, general surgery, ENT. So I would say there's no specific or defined path through aerospace medicine. I think there's a recognition now that aerospace medicine, while it does have a significant occupational medicine component, also has values other specialties as well. And so emergency medicine is a good route to the space medicine world, but certainly not the only route.
Very cool. So that kind of is good lead into just kind of maybe two different groups of people to think about: your undergraduate medical students in the first and second years who are kind of thinking about their clinical and post-clinical time, and then your third and fourth years who are in the clinical and really thinking about the residency applications. So I was wondering if you can kind of give each different group some pointers about like how to think about, is space medicine the way I want to go? If it is, like what kind of things should I be doing to set myself up for success?
The for the first and the second years, I would say that the focus of that point is and primarily should be your medical school work. And doing well in medical school is obviously going to help you get into the residency of your choice, and that's the best thing you can do for yourself. But for the folks who are early on in their med school career and they are interested in this area, one recommendation I have is to find groups of people or like-minded people that you can talk to about this. So an example there is an aerospace medical association, and it goes by ASMA, ASMA. And that group has an aerospace medicine student and resident organization. And so there's a whole bunch of people, not only from around the country, but from around the world, who are all interested in the same area, and you can share resources, you can find out information about a research project you might be able to work on. It's really great to start developing your network early and to find your people. And I will say, as a person in medicine who's interested in space, most people in medicine, when you say that you're interested in space, they don't understand what you're talking about. They're like, "That's not a real thing. You can't do medicine in space. Like, why don't you just go into a normal specialty?" And I got that a lot. And so for me early on, finding the people that thought like I did and were interested in the same things I was interested in was critical. And so a group like ASMA is great because it starts to connect you with a broader network of people. But they also have resources and a journal you can read and all this kind of stuff that starts to help you learn about that niche area. The other thing I would say for the early career med students is look around your university or wherever you are and see if you can find people who are interested in space medicine. So as an example, I'll give you, when I was at GW, I had a first year medical student just send me an email out of the blue because I had written on my faculty bio that I was interested in space medicine. And he just randomly sent me this note and he's like, "Hey, I think space medicine's cool. Can I come talk to you?" And as a result of that initial conversation, he and I ended up doing probably, I think, three different research projects together, multiple ones of those which he presented at conferences and then wrote them up and had them published as papers. And so being able to identify local people who you can look up to as mentors or who you can partner with on research projects or other projects, it's not as hard as you think. And as long as you do some good internet sleuthing, you can find these people out there and just start sending those cold emails. You might not get answers to all of them, but you will get answers to some of them. And so I think that's really important. For the later career med students, the third years and the fourth years, something that was invaluable to me is that the NASA Johnson Space Center offers a 1 month aerospace medicine elective.
Oh, cool.
And you can apply for it. It's a competitive process, but I actually applied for it four times and got it on the fourth try. And once I was in residency at that point, but it's an amazing experience to be able to go work at a NASA center, learn from flight surgeons, participate in research, and start to really get a feel for whether or not you want to pursue that area as part of your career. So I would say apply early and apply often, if you have an interest in that kind of aerospace medicine elective.
And I'm sure that there are some residency programs around the country who have fellowships or a little bit more focus on emergency, oh, sorry, on aerospace medicine. I can think of University of Colorado, where I used to work, as being one of those places. So, is there a good way to look up, like, a good location for where those are?
There's no kind of one-stop shop or clearinghouse, if you will, for where those opportunities are. I think that the most of those are captured or can be captured through something like the Aerospace Medical Association. But as you said, Colorado would be a great example of a place that probably doesn't show up on a formal aerospace medicine training pathway because it doesn't have that kind of program, but yet has a bioastronautics program where they have master's students that are focused exclusively on trying to figure out how to deal with human health and performance in space. And so that's a great example of how some of the less traditional training paths, like hooking up with a group of engineers and deciding to be their medical expert for a research project that they're working on at a graduate student level is a really cool way of starting to get involved in that kind of stuff. And so that's why I think that the looking around your local institution for anyone that might be doing something that's space worthy or relevant, is a great way to start trying to make those connections and find cool opportunities.
Very neat. Okay, I think that's going to probably be a good place to wrap up with that after that excellent advice from you. Any last parting words you want to communicate about space medicine and your time at NASA?
I think what I'd love for people to take away from this is that emergency medicine is an awesome specialty to be part of if you have a number of different niche interests. And it's one of those things where I was able to find ways in my career in emergency medicine to carve out time to work on these niche areas because of the nature of emergency medicine. And so I do think it's one of the benefits of being an emergency physician. But at the same time, even in this circumstance, I ended up where I ended up because I followed a very unconventional path. And I remember going on job interviews where I would say to people, "Hey, I'd really like to come and work here." And they'd say, "Oh, our emergency department would love to have you. But by the way, everyone in emergency medicine has a niche. Tell me what yours is." And I'm like, "Oh, mine's aerospace medicine." And they said, "Oh, well, we don't do that here." And I said, "Thank you very much." And I went to the next interview. And I went to one where eventually I said the same thing and I heard the same thing back. I heard, "We don't do that here." But then there was a pause. And then they said, "But we could. Do you have ideas?" And I was like, "Yeah, I have lots of ideas." So not everyone's going to understand what you want to do. Not everyone's going to necessarily see your path as being a straight path to follow. But if it's what you want to do, there's a way to do it. You just got to find it. And it can be challenging, but it's awfully rewarding too.
That's perfect. All right. Well, thank you so much again for joining us today. It was an absolute pleasure to speak with you. And I found it very interesting to learn more about space medicine because I've never really heard about it. And so this is, yeah, very enlightening and was wonderful. So to our listeners out there, if you'd like any more information about emergency medicine, please feel free to reach out to our website at gwuemig.com and reach out with any questions. And thank you again. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Will. Appreciate it.